Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here at the home of Common Sense. It is, of course, Talk Radio. I've returned to the studio after a very sombre weekend following the horrific murder of MP Sir David Amos. The suspect has been named as Ali Harvey Ali, whose father moved to the UK from Somalia, where he was an advisor to the previous government. This morning, as police continue to question him, there are suggestions that the killer may have been motivated by Sir David's links to Qatar, which supports the current regime in the African nation. I feel that we are now living in a very global world. We are living in a very globalised world. There seems to be no apparent reason why a man like Ali Harvey Ali, who was brought up in this country, who went to school in Croydon, but who has been radicalised in some way by Islamic fundamentalists, should want to kill one of the most popular MPs that has ever been in the House of Commons. All weekend, there have been calls for people to be nicer to one another, not just on social media, but in politics generally. There has been much talk of previous incidents involving MPs and the need for better security, but it's also time, surely, to talk about the ever-increasing threat that exists to all of us from bedroom radicals who have been converted to terrorism during lockdown. Ali himself is thought to have been radicalised by the hate preacher Anjem Chowdhury, who was jailed in 2015, but is now free to wander the streets of the UK after being released on licence. And surely, in the wake of intelligence service warnings about Northeast African Islamic terror groups, it is time to properly check the identities of those young men entering our country illegally on the dinghies that reach our shores every single day. We know for a fact that many of them are coming from those very Northeast African countries that Al-Qaeda are continually recruiting in. 0344 499 1000. Up first this morning, we're talking to Brendan Clark-Smith, Tory MP for Bassett Law, who has himself received death threats because of his stance against taking the knee at football. I'll be asking him exactly what we should be doing to safeguard our politicians and where he stands on the robust political debates we should or should not be having. Security expert Will Geddes is checking in as well. We'll ask him just whether it's even viable to have bodyguards around the clock for our members of parliament. Peter Hitchens is here as well with his take of the events on the weekend. Plus, I'll be asking him about his column in the Mail on Sunday, where he points out that this country now is primed for yet another lockdown, regardless of COVID, and what happens this winter. 0344 499 1000. We'll be talking doctors once again today as well, with the latest from the BMA, who now reckon that forcing GPs to actually see patients is harassment and discrimination. Huh? And the news that it's now official, mass testing children in school is a total waste of time. 0344 499 1000. We've got a new feature for you today as well, which is going to kick off and run probably all the way through the winter months. It's going to be called Shortage of the Day, because we're now being warned that there's going to be a shortage of pies. There's going to be a shortage of bus drivers. I want you to tell me what you think there's going to be a shortage of. And if you have found that there is a shortage of something, by all means, get in touch. We'll be running a tally. We'll be running a little chart that comes out every single day. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, there's been an awful lot said, an awful lot meant well, an awful lot of very, very kind words being said, both by the family of the now unfortunately passed away MP Sir David Amos, who appears to have been one of the most popular MPs, not just in the House of Commons, but in his own constituency in Essex, where he was murdered on Friday afternoon. I spent Friday driving for a couple of hours during the time at which the incident took place. It started, as I set off from London, with the attack, where it said a man had been stabbed. It then became that a man had been detained at the scene. It then became a man had died at the scene. It then became clear that it was Sir David Amos who had in fact died at the scene at the hands of what can only be described as a ghastly terrorist, a coward, a man who stabbed him multiple times. We know not why. The police have still not charged anybody, but the suspect, who they have in custody, has a Somalian heritage. He came with his father from Somalia. He was brought up in South London. He was thought to have been radicalised. And now here we are with the intelligence services telling us that there could be many, many more of these kind of bedroom activists, these horrible people who are likely to want to do harm because they have been radicalised into an extreme form of Islamic terror. Let's talk now to Brendan Clarke-Smith, Conservative MP for Bassett Law, one of those who came into Parliament relatively recently, and will have a very interesting view, of course, on all of this. Brendan, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning, Mike. Thanks for having me on today.
I mean, obviously, it's a solemn weekend that we've all had. It's been a terrible time for Sir David's friends and family. And he had many friends in the area of where his constituency was. He seemed to work tirelessly for almost everybody. I mean, there's nothing really that you can say which isn't exemplary about the man.
Yeah, I mean, David gave Parliament a good name and is so well thought of across the House. And even though I've not been an MP for very long, Mike, you know, David would go out of his way to speak with people. He was always interested in whatever subject you wanted to talk about. And that was a very, very genuine, always had a smile on his face. And, you know, he's really everything that you would want to see in Parliament. So it's what makes it even harder to take, really, to lose somebody who was such a great man and in such an appalling manner. And, you know, I was heartbroken when I heard the news on Friday. I'd been doing a constituency surgery myself, went to do a visit and then saw my phone and I got a message from my wife about it and rushed back to the office, and then unfortunately we'd heard that David had passed away.
I mean, at that sort of time, do you think of your own safety, Brendan? Because obviously I'm sure an awful lot of MPs have pondered that over the course of the weekend.
Yeah, and I've had the tough conversation at home, as many of my colleagues probably have, about, you know, do you really still want to be doing this, especially when you've got young families and so on? And I'd say, well, yeah, absolutely, and we must carry on. And what we mustn't let it do, Mike, is we mustn't let it stop us having that bond with the public that we have. And it's so important that we actually get to see people, we get out and about, we get to speak to our constituents. And, you know, we don't want to see that thrown away because the actions of one evil person who's done this. And I think there's two different issues here. There's the one, as you've said, about the radicalised, the terrorist approach. And then there's also a wider conversation about the abuse that members of Parliament receive, the level of political discourse and so on. So, yeah, it does make you think. But, I mean, certainly it's strengthened my resolve to carry on more than anything, really. And I'm sure that's what David would want as well.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, Priti Patel obviously has been very protective of MPs and said there's going to be conversations, I think, going on today in Parliament between yourselves and members of the police and as to what they can do to protect you. But at the end of the day, you know, there's not very much they can do to protect you around the clock. Alistair Carmichael was speaking over the weekend, the Lib Dem MP, and he was saying, well, it's all very well having somebody with you at a constituency surgery, but, you know, what about when you go out with your wife to the theatre, or when you go out for dinner, or you're sitting on a train? I mean, you know, you can't have 24/7 security like the President of the United States of America, can you?
No, Alistair's right there. And it's the thing. I mean, you can be careful at surgeries. You can make it appointment only. You can screen people in advance, and you can take other measures. So not telling people where the venue is until later on, or advertising your whereabouts. Mm. So there's things you can do to minimise risk. Yeah, I mean, we have things like panic alarms and things fitted to our houses and so on. But if you're a public figure, there's always the possibility that that's there. And the one thing I would say is, you know, our police officers, our emergency service workers, they put themselves at this kind of risk every day as well. So it's not just politicians there. But, yeah, we can minimise the risk, but I don't think you'll ever entirely get rid of it, no, Mike.
No, I think that's right. And, I mean, as far as the way that the arguments have been developing over the course of the weekend, there seems to be an awful lot of people on both sides of the debate who are kind of saying, well, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens when the public debate becomes toxic. I mean, I know you yourself have suffered at the hands of various Twitter trolls because of the stance you took on not taking the knee and what people should be doing about all of that. But I think there's a huge difference, isn't there, between, you know, people being rude to each other, either in person or indeed on Twitter, and some maniac who's taken it upon himself to act on behalf of Allah and murder an MP because he doesn't like what he does.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it helps with political discourse and calling people scum and so on. I always say about my political opponents, you know, I don't think that they're scum or anything like that. I just think that they're wrong. And we just have to agree to disagree on those things. But I do think sometimes the way that that discourse goes on, it can encourage bad behaviour from other people. And I get dozens of abusive emails and not very nice things written on social media. And I'm the first to admit, you know, I can be a bit of a wind-up merchant sometimes, and I generally just brush it off. The thing for me when it crossed the line was when people started threatening members of my family. I had a very unpleasant individual when I'd made the comments about taking the knee and criticizing that, talking about kneeling on my children's necks until they were dead. And I think yeah, exactly. And that kind of crosses the point, I think.
Yes. And were you able to figure out who that was? Were you able to get a satisfaction on that?
Yeah. So they found out who he was. He was arrested and obviously punished for that. But as we say, I mean, it's part of a wider problem, this abuse of MPs. And I think there's this idea about MPs, you know, that we're lazy or we're all on the take or so on. And, yeah, they don't realise there's a human being behind that. And it encourages that kind of behaviour. But as you said, Mike, I think that's very different, again, from this sort of radical sort of Islamist problem, which we've had for many years now and that also needs tackling. And, of course, making sure that our security services are on top of that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's clearly very difficult for them because there's an awful lot of people here in this country who either have come here as a second generation or who have been radicalised while they've been here by absolute scumbags. And I'm going to call Anjem Chowdhury a scumbag without fear or favour. And also there are those who will come here who have come just first time as immigrants who may have some kind of radical agenda. And it seems to me that this is a time to separate those people out and say, you know, we need to know who they are. We need to know if they're coming here, if they have those intentions. And we need, as Boris Johnson said at Tory party conference, you know, we should have the right to know who is entering our country.
Yeah, I think calling Anjem Chowdhury a scumbag is quite kind, Mike.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And the security services, again, if it's a long-running thing or it's planned and so on, then they can track that. But when you get these lone wolf attacks that happen all of a sudden, the more unsophisticated ones, they're the more difficult ones. But as you said, I mean, it highlights the problem that we've got rarely, and when people are coming into the country, we need to know who they are, and we need to know that they accept our values, and we need to know that we're going to be safe, really. So absolutely, I agree with that.
Yeah, and again, I mean, I'm not even that bothered about necessarily accepting our values or having a cultural difference of opinion with us or having different views to us, but what I don't want them to be thinking that they can do is to go around randomly murdering people.
Yeah, it's appalling, I think, in any culture, really, to go and do that. So, you know, you have to ask what kind of people are doing this, and you know, whether that's being brainwashed and radicalised in their bedrooms or whether there's a wider issue there that needs tackling. But clearly, you know, this isn't going to go away anytime soon, and we have to be super vigilant over it.
No, of course we do. And the point is that, you know, this guy was apparently referred to something called Prevent, which is apparently a voluntary situation whereby if you think that you might be being radicalized, you can go and talk to someone about it. I mean, it doesn't sound very hard line to me. It doesn't sound like the way to go, to be honest.
No, and I'd like to hear more of that. And as you're saying, the details are still emerging, really. Saw another report that saying he'd considered looking at other members of parliament as well. So it wasn't necessarily just one that had been picked out in that sense. So I suppose we'll only find out about this as the details emerge. But yeah, it is quite worrying that if this person's been on the radar at some point, whether he's slipped through the net or whether they ever thought there was a problem, or as you say, whether it was just a self-referral or not. But again, I'm sure this is something that the investigation is going to bring out.
Yeah. And I think we were told back in the days of 7/7 that Al-Qaeda and ISIS basically had declared war on Britain. And so it is a kind of a state generally that we are in. You know, it's not as if it's going to change. It's not as if it's going to get any better. But it certainly, I would say, puts even further pressure on Priti Patel to control those people, not only who are here, who need to be up on the watch list, but to also control those coming in. And when there's no sense of that. I mean, somebody put out a tweet at the weekend saying since Sir David was murdered, another 300 people have arrived on our beaches. Now, we're told that Somalia and Northeast Africa at the moment are particular recruiting grounds for Al-Qaeda and ISIS and every other every other kind of, you know, Islamic terror group. So surely if we know people are coming from there, we need to be very careful.
We do, yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a wider part of the law as well. I mean, even when we do know people are a threat and they're over here, actually getting rid of them is quite problematic, as we've seen. You know, we've seen this kind of activist lawyers exhausting the appeals process.
Well, in this guy's case, he was British. I mean, so you can't really get rid of him anyway, but you just need to know what he's up to.
Yeah, precisely. But this is the problem, really. I mean, you speak about people coming over on the boats, Mike, and yeah, that's something we do need to stop. But you know, whether that's working with the French authorities or whether that's passing the new Nationality and Borders Act that we're trying to get in, that's going to allow us to actually deport people who we actually don't want to be here and not here for the right reasons. But so that's going to take a while to come in. And in the meantime, we need to make sure that the people who are coming over, we know everything that we can about them.
Yeah. And I mean, the other question that's being raised this weekend is, what on earth is this guy doing living in a council property in a street in Kentish Town that most people can't afford to walk down, never mind live in? I mean, I can't afford to live in. Giles Corran lives in the same street. You know, this is a wealthier part of London. And yet he appears to be living there on the council coin.
Yeah, I think I saw a valuation of about £2 million on it, which, yeah.
Very good, it's not very nice, too.
Yeah, as I say, I mean, perhaps we need a review of the way that we do housing stock in this country generally. I think I read a lot of these stories, and you do see some people living a life of luxury and don't really appreciate it either. So, yeah, obviously, wherever somebody lives, they can be radicalised, as we've seen. And, you know, it's one of these things that you'd have thought, yeah, this isn't a bad country to live in, I don't think. I don't understand where this hatred comes from.
No, I think some of us could explain where some of it comes from. But, Brendan, stay with us if you would, because we've got a couple more questions for you. Parliament's back today, of course. There will be tributes paid to Sir David Amis. There will be a minute's silence, of course, as well. Brendan Clark-Smith, Conservative MP for Bassett Law, is here with us.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Peter Hitchens is here with us later on in this show, of course. Brendan Clark-Smith with us right now, Conservative MP for Bassett Law. Back in the House today, Brendan, first kind of session of the new term, if you like. Obviously, there will be an awful lot of attention paid to the events of the weekend, but still many other things to talk about as well. COVID passports, vaccine passports, you know, we see the introduction today in Scotland, where apparently, even if you are exempt from getting the vaccination or you have a medical reason, you won't be able to go to a nightclub. It's like a two-tier medical system apartheid they're bringing in. What's your view of what will happen in our parliament in the UK?
I disagreed with vaccine passports. It was the idea with the vaccines generally. I've always encouraged people to get it. I've had it myself, but I've always said it's important you have a choice to do that. And as you said, you don't want this two-tier system coming in. So I'm glad that we didn't introduce it, Mike, to be honest. I was surprised that Scotland did it. I think there's just been a tendency there in Scotland to try and I think Nicola Sturgeon trying to get in there before the rest of the UK and try and sort of set the pace in terms of what's happening. And there's kind of done the opposite in this case, where we've actually, I think, pursued quite a sensible policy and they've gone the opposite way. But I think they'll have problems. You see what's happened in France and in Italy and other places like that. It's not going particularly well. So I think we have to be very careful before we go down that route. And there'll be a lot of people who are very upset about it. But I think the bigger problem is just in terms of logistics. You know, this is a big thing for a lot of venues that are already having a lot of extra costs as it is. And it's just one extra hurdle for them to get over.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, are you fairly certain that it won't happen here then? Because it's almost impossible to tell now whenever you speak to cabinet ministers, because one minute they're saying, oh, absolutely no reason to introduce them. And the next minute they're saying, well, we reserve the right to introduce them if we feel it's necessary. I just don't really know anymore.
Well, it's one of those barring a huge third wave all of a sudden, which I don't think is going to happen, that I can't see it coming in, Mike, no. But, yeah, they don't like to state things as a certainty with COVID, because we haven't really had certainty all the way through. So I think they're right to just be cautious with that and to keep things in reserve. But I don't think realistically there's any prospect of that. I would probably look at things like the booster campaign that's going on. We've got to be careful around Christmas. I know they talk about pressure on the NHS, but then it's under pressure every winter.
Well, exactly. I mean, we're going to hear that narrative now for a while, aren't we? I mean, today, the most ridiculous story, I think, and we'll talk about it later on, is the BMA claiming that doctors who are being forced, in their words, to have face-to-face consultations with patients are suffering from discrimination and harassment. It's like, sorry, you're a doctor, go and see a patient. That's not harassment or discrimination. That's you doing your job.
Yeah, I mean, I declare an interest, Mike. I'm married to one. So I do have this discussion.
Well, I hope she's seeing patients face to face. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble from me.
Absolutely. And the thing is, they have been doing throughout the pandemic as well. I think maybe because there's a bit of a backlog, as we know, and because people are seeing big queues, they're not necessarily getting their phone call answered sometimes. But doctors are actually working, and I know they're getting a lot of stick at the moment, but they are pretty much flat out. And whether that's in A&E, whether that's in the departments, whether that's GPs, they are actually putting a lot of work in. So I do think it's right we give them a bit of extra support there to try and relieve it a bit, try and get that kind of that backlog of patients sorted out. But I think what the BMA is saying, I mean, they're probably reflecting some of the wider stick that doctors are getting at the moment. But in terms of face-to-face, really, I mean, that's what it's all about. Same as we were talking about.
Yeah, but I mean, the only reason we're in this place, Brendan, is because the NHS is so badly run and it needs to be run properly. And I think now is the time, if we're going to have a Tory party which is genuinely going to radicalise Britain and make Britain better, then the first thing they should do is fix the NHS, isn't it?
Well, it needs reforming, certainly. Yeah, I mean, you can't just keep throwing cash at something. We do spend a lot of money on healthcare in this country, and I think the problem is, in the past, it's been very difficult to have any sort of conversation about the NHS without people waving their arms in the air, accusing you of trying to privatise it or whatever else it is. And I've lived abroad in various countries with different systems. Lived in Scandinavia, where they have a decent healthcare system, and you know, a lot of countries do things differently to us. So doing it differently doesn't mean that you're privatising it or you're doing anything else. It just means you're looking at it like you would with any organisation. I don't see why we can't do that.
Yeah, it's not just that they do it differently, it's that nobody does it the way we do it. You know, we are single-handedly doing it this way. Nobody else thinks it's a good idea. But Brendan, great to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the show. Brendan Clarke-Smith, MP, Conservative MP for Bassett Law, making an awful lot of very, very sensible points there, because that is, of course, what we do here at the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Can I also, by the way, state for the record that today, aside from my socks, everything I'm wearing is recycled, okay? People are making a big deal of the Duke of Cornwall. Is that what he is? Prince of whatever he's called? No, Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. There you go. Prince William and Catherine apparently wearing recycled clothes. Hers is recycled. It's a dress she wore before. Yeah, so is this jacket, this tie I've worn, the shirt I've worn before. I mean, don't get me wrong. They are all, they've been washed, you know, they've been pressed. They are, you know, clean. But I have worn them before. So does that mean I can qualify now for £1 million grant, please, from Prince William in order to be the newest eco-warrior here at Talk Radio? I'll be putting my application form in forthwith.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let us talk now continually about what we were mentioning earlier on about the death, the murder, the brutal terrorist attack committed against Sir David Amis, of course, MP, on Friday. Will Geddes is here, security expert, a man who knows a thing or two about protecting valuable targets, as people in his business call them. Will, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for talking to us. I mean, clearly, this was a ghastly, horrific act, which not very many people in even your business perhaps could have stopped. But I mean, listening to some of the suggestions over the weekend about, you know, having constant bodyguards 24/7 around the clock for all MPs, apart from the fact that it would probably cost quite a lot of money to the public purse, it's not really practical, is it?
Not in the slightest, Mike. The suggestion of actually having close protection for all MPs is, unless it's serviced by the private sector, a company like mine, for example, it would be impossible to deliver by the police. The police are under-resourced as it is. I mean, they have difficulties getting to investigate burglaries and street crimes and everything else for that matter. But if you gave it to the private sector, maybe even a company not as expensive as mine, Mike, it would cost an absolute fortune. Mm. And the question is it round the clock or is it just for their surgeries? And as we know with terrorists, they'll look for the path of least resistance. So if there's security at their surgeries, the terrorists might just pick the opportunity when they've left the surgery or they're going about their own normal business.
Well, that's right. I mean, without wishing to give away any sort of commercial secrets, Will, I mean, to cover somebody around the clock 24/7, what sort of a daily cost is that?
Well, I mean, to provide it to the sort of level that, say, Priti Patel has, you'd be looking probably around £3,000 to £5,000 every 24 hours.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's an awful lot of money when he's adding that up.
Right, it really is. And also, you know, if one person is doing it, you then need another person to cover when they can't do it. And you need, you know, you've suddenly got a whole industry going on around it. And as you say, one person might not be enough anyway. Because, I mean, if you're doing an event, for example, and you're protecting a high-level target, as you would call them, even just in a relatively safe arena, say a rock star going to a gig, or, you know, a politician going to make a speech, you know, you need a lot of people, and you need a lot of vehicles, and you need a lot of infrastructure, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's an awful lot of planning around it. I mean, I'll be honest with you, Mike. I've looked after a lot of very, very famous people in the public eye who are at very high risk. And many of those people do not want security 24 hours, even though they know that they're extremely exposed without it. It's a real impingement potentially on people's lives. And therefore, the delivery of it is absolutely critical. And if it's not delivered by a professional company, then it's going to fall down very, very quickly. I mean, I certainly know of some companies who've had principals trying to lose their security because they hate it so much. Mm. So, you know, it has to be done sensibly. And I think the only way that we can do this, Mike, is to actually have personal consultancy with each of the MPs to sit down, look at their lives, look at what they're doing, making sure that they're adopting certain security protocols which aren't going to adjust their personal lives too much, but will minimize and reduce the risk potentially to them. But this has got to be delivered by threat management specialists. It can't be delivered by some community support officer. Mm. This is a very, very specialist field, Mike, as you know.
No, of course. And the other sort of conversations, I suppose, that they'll be having today within Parliament with the police and advising to some of the individual MPs, you know, things like, for example, would it be sensible, for example, to set up a kind of a post office style counter almost, so that when people talk to MPs, they're behind a screen. Is there any point in that or not really?
Well, you know, to be honest, I mean, I think as long as coronavirus seems to be a key agenda for everybody, you can could excuse having screens between the MP and their constituents. However, I'm sure with most MPs, they're not going to want to have that. They probably went into that role because they wanted that face-to-face contact with their constituents. And anything that creates a divide or a block between them and their constituents, it's not going to be well received. Mm. However, I think what they should be thinking about is, where are they holding these surgeries? Holding them in a church in a remote area is probably not what I would suggest the best idea. There are companies, there are offices, there are retail centres that already have contract security, that already have perhaps checks at the door, bag searches, security gates. Then why aren't they using those kind of facilities? And maybe they can adopt the security that's already in place, not adding to the extra cost to the taxpayer.
And as far as the Telegraph story this morning about these bedroom radicals, there's a fear that there might be some kind of epidemic of bedroom radicals like this guy, Ali, who have been radicalised over the course of the last couple of years, maybe even before that. And as long as there's people like Anjum Chowdhury around, you know, that's entirely possible. It's a massive problem, this, isn't it?
It is a huge problem, Mike. And when we look at the demographic of the individuals and their age category, you know, a lot of these people will have the prevalence of social media in their lives. They'll be seeking out content online. I mean, one of the things you and I have discussed personally was probably the biggest casualty of this whole lockdown process that we've been through is probably going to be mental health. And I think a lot of people who are in isolation found themselves vulnerable, susceptible, uncertain of their future, and therefore much more vulnerable to perhaps radicalization. And that's not to say everybody would, but there are those within the corners of society that might.
Well, that is the problem, isn't it? And I mean, how big of a deal is this for the security services? Because obviously we know that at any given time, they're probably tracking something like 500 plots in one way or another, anything ranging from, you know, suicide attacks to places like Parliament, to attacks at railway stations, to attacks at places like the Manchester Arena. You know, they're tracking people constantly. I mean, it's an impossible task, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, and you can up that number to about 700, Mike. But also bearing in mind there are some 40,000 subjects of interest or persons of interest that the security services have on their radar. Obviously, the spectrum of those that are higher risk are at one end. And then you have individuals like this perpetrator who was at the lower end, who didn't even get into the channel program. You know, they were only in the prevent program. And that, to a certain extent, is more social worker level. Their details are not necessarily logged, aren't necessarily passed on to the security services, and it's more voluntary than anything else.
I mean, I was listening to a lot of the chatter over the course of the week. Andrew Rossendale, who's an MP that we speak to quite a lot on this show, he talks about having his car vandalised. He talks about having his office, his constituency office, the victim of an arson attack. Somebody tried to break into his home. I mean, you know, there's a lot more of this going on than we know. And that obviously isn't necessarily terror related, but it's nuisance related. It's certainly criminal activity. It would certainly suggest that if you're an MP, you would want your home to be made quite secure.
Mike, we live in toxic times, unfortunately. I mean, you only have to go onto Twitter to see the cesspool of individuals who just have hate that they want to spit out at everybody in every single direction. MPs are an easy target in many regards because obviously they are representative of the government. They're representative of the agendas which are currently being discussed in the mainstream media. So, you know, as a result, there are those that are very disenchanted, disgruntled, with malintent, who want to, you know, fundamentally throw everything they can at them. Now, in many cases, having dealt with many, many death threats for clients over the years, there are some that you can calculate down to simply being, you know, from the bottom of a wine glass or a beer glass at 11 o'clock at night. Quite often it's down to the time of day that that message is sent, which will tell you an awful lot about who that person might be and how genuine that threat might be. But I generalize that. There are those, obviously, that are persistent threats. And so, you know, MPs are in the firing line of all sorts of abuse, potentially on a daily basis. And it's measuring what needs to be done and how it can be done. So this kind of security measures and this consultancy for each of them, I think is a necessity anyway, Mike, regardless of what tragedy that we've just faced.
Mm, absolutely. And just for an individual, I mean, I know there are a lot of MPs listening to this show, and you might think that they know more than they do, because a lot of them probably don't know much about this kind of business. I mean, how should they be able to judge a threat? Because as we found out, many of them are getting them. I mean, I get them as well. I mean, I don't pay attention to most of them, but I think if I was concerned about one, I would talk to you about it and say, what do you make of this? I mean, what could ordinary individual MPs do if they get a threat of some kind?
Well, again, it depends on the content of the threat. If it's an actual threat to harm, it's I am going to come and kill you, or I am going to come and murder your family, or I am going, and they give any kind of particular indicators that they know exactly where they are or what their routine is or where they might be. Again, one of the things that you and I both know is we don't tweet our location if we've been somewhere until after we've left it, for example.
Right.
You know, we're very cautious about not actually putting out there where we are at that precise time. A lot of celebrities got caught out on that by paparazzi when Twitter first started appearing.
Yes.
So it's a good example there. But if there is a specific threat, then obviously they should be calling the police straight away. Mm. Let the police investigate it. Look at the person. But the problem is the anonymity behind social media, and particularly Twitter. I've followed the procedural process of trying to identify some very nasty threats via Twitter. And it's almost pointless, Mike. Mm. So it's about making sure that you are recording and you're documenting those kind of messages. I mean, evidently, if you can block them, great. But fundamentally, keep a record of them, because that is going to show a course of conduct under the Harassment Act, which the police can then utilise in prosecuting that individual or arresting them, for that matter.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Will Geddes, their security expert, giving us the lowdown on what it would take and how much it would cost to actually make sure that all MPs are protected at all times, no matter what they're doing. I don't think it's practical. I don't think it's affordable. And I probably don't think it's wise either. However, I do think that there are certain things that could be done. There are precautions that can be made. There's been a big debate going on social media about whether or not social media accounts should be made to be more than not just named, but actually linked to proper individuals, so that, you know, you're either an organization or you're a person, but you cannot be any longer anonymous. You cannot be a troll. You cannot set up a fake account which is not in your name. You cannot have a fake account which is linked to a fake email address or a fake bank account. You know, you must prove who you are before you can go on social media. And all these kind of, you know, freedom of speech warriors who want to make sure that anybody can say anything or do anything, because that's what life is all about. Well, I'm sorry, if you're going to be an absolute horror show and you're going to go around making threats to people, and you're going to go around, you know, saying what terrible harm you're going to do to people, well, I don't think you should have the right to be on social media, and you certainly shouldn't be anonymous. I don't think that is at all justifiable.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Talk Radio.
Let us, without further ado, speak to Mr. Peter Hitchens from the Mail on Sunday. Peter, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Terribly sad. Sorry.
Reports that this morning I encountered a severe shortage of common sense. All the places where I normally get it were out.
Well, at least luckily you've checked into the home of common sense, which indeed is alive and kicking
here. Manufacture some.
Here at Talk Radio. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is extraordinary what we're now being told we're going to run out of, but we'll come to that later on. Let's start with the piece that you drew attention to at the weekend after the horrible incidents in Essex with Sir David Amos and the attack on him by this, what would appear to be a radical Islamic terrorist. You picked up on the fact that there was a Catholic priest in attendance because Sir David was quite a devout Catholic, and there seemed to be a problem there.
Well, I didn't pick up on it. I mean, with several national newspapers picked up on it on Sunday morning, and I noticed it. I have to say, I'm not myself a Roman Catholic, and I don't. I wouldn't expect to be given the last rites by a priest, but I know people who are Roman Catholics, and I know how incredibly seriously they and their families often take this. And when I saw that this had happened, I was astonished by it, because I still have this idea in my head, even though everything I know tells me it's wrong, that the police are a relatively conservative, common sense organization. And I posted a tweet saying that whatever else this event showed that Britain could certainly no longer be called a Christian country. I think 50 years ago, if a priest had appeared at a scene where a known Roman Catholic was dying, the police would have let him through without a second's thought. Mm. It would have been a normal thing to do, but all that's gone now.
Well, I suppose you could argue
it doesn't apply to this sort of thing. And this isn't because of hostility exactly. I mean, no doubt there are people in the police as everywhere else who are hostile to religious faith of one kind or another, but in general, the police are just ignorant of it and indifferent to it, as so much of our society is. Simply don't know. And I've been engaged in the most terrible Twitter brawls for the past 12 hours or so with people who simply can't understand that this might matter to anybody.
Yeah.
That's what disturbs me. And I just so happen to know that it matters. Anybody who's read or indeed watched the amazing television adaptation of Evelyn Waugh's great novel, Brideshead Revisited, will know the final scenes are all about this very issue of how important it is to the family of a dying man that he receives the last rites. And it just is an important thing. And I'm just surprised by how lightly people take it and have yourself a priest, not an emergency service. And it might in some way corrupt the crime scene. If you go, all kinds of people are present at crime scenes when people are dying. And nobody says you can't let a, and quite rightly, nobody says you can't let a doctor or a paramedic in because they might corrupt the crime scene, because what they're doing is good. I happen to think that if somebody is dying and their faith makes them believe they should have a priest at the end, then that person is an emergency service and should be allowed in. I'm just astonished at the anger which people have expressed at this suggestion.
Yes, but I think, I mean, more than likely, this is, as you say, not because of anything other than perhaps either indifference or the ludicrous health and safety nonsense, you know, where somebody nevertheless is actually lying dying and the health and safety rules, so you mustn't let anybody else near them in case they might be also wishing to do them harm. Even though they may look like a priest, they may not be a priest. But more important, I think, is what you say, that people say all the time now, what does it matter? I mean, I saw Alistair Campbell tweeting at the weekend, you know, what's the big deal about wearing a mask on the underground? You know, I see people saying things like that all the time. Well, the big deal is that some people don't wish to do it and therefore will not do it. And it's as simple as that. And it's their choice.
Well, so, the thing, I mean, if I have to say that there have been countries in which the people would be more or less compelled to have the attentions of priests at the end when they didn't believe. And I would very much support them in resisting that. I don't because I can imagine being an unbeliever who did not want a priest at the end, just as readily as I can imagine being a Roman Catholic believer who did.
Yeah,
it's just the absence of sympathy for other people holding different views from your own, and the way in which the expression of and I get this all the time, the expression of a dissenting view from any conventional wisdom is not just treated as the expression of a dissenting view, but is treated as a hostile act, which must itself be greeted with hostility and rage and anger. And the implicit attitude in this that I shouldn't be allowed so much as to say it, which is why I constantly fear for what remains of our freedom of speech and thought in this country, which is under relentless attack on the small scale and on the large scale everywhere, in places of work, in the media, everywhere, that indeed in the courts and in the police. The whole idea that people should be able to have a divergence of dissenting opinions from conventional wisdom is now under question. And we are moving with extraordinary rapidity towards a society in which only one point of view will be permitted.
Yeah, and that was your other sort of main piece in the column this Sunday about how we seem to have become so sort of culled, if you like, and sort of, you know, made to kneel by society and by authority, that you fear that we are now kind of creating a rod for our own backs, if you like, that they will introduce these various different measures at will whenever they want to.
I think the fascinating thing about the parliamentary report last week on the COVID crisis was that it presumed, without, as far as I can see, any serious attempt to study the global evidence on it, it simply presumed that shutting down society was a good response. And this presumption was immediately accepted, again, in our culture and in the media, as a normal thing to say without examination. And we have surrendered by accepting this. And I do grasp that people have accepted that this is not just out of the majority opinion, but the opinion which almost everybody holds, apart from a very few dissenters such as me. By accepting this, we have opened ourselves to another set of shutdowns on some other pretext and given to the state and the police and the government enormous powers which they didn't previously possess over us, because we have failed to defend the freedoms we had before. And that's what happens. If you have a freedom and you don't defend it, you lose it, and we have now lost it. And that, the fact that that report said what I've said many times on this program, when the reports start to come in, they will say we did not lock down soon enough or hard enough, and everybody will accept it. And this is already beginning to happen. And that's the way it goes. Why we are so flaccid and placid and willing to have this stuff done to us when we're supposed to be the great nation of the tradition of freedom and the Bill of Rights and Magna Carta, I'm not sure. But there it is. That's what we are. So if we don't want to be free, I absolutely promise you we won't be.
No. And did it just happen, though, do you think, when the first lockdown came about? Because I know you and I have spoken about this many times, and when we first started this conversation, you and I differed on why it happened. Because back then, I was under the impression that it was only going to go on for a few weeks, and that you would never really know whether it safeguarded the NHS or not. And I still think that, in a way, that you still can. You can't really prove it one way or the other.
Well,
unfortunately,
try using the NHS at the moment.
Well, yeah.
Safeguarded.
Yeah. No, listen. I'm perfectly willing to admit that you were far righter than I was. While I may say still keep a smidgen of possible rightness, because I thought if it was just a little short reason to stop. I saw a piece, I don't know if you saw it the weekend in the Sunday Times, about the guy responsible for the lockdown, who it turns out is some kind of technical geek, a physics major, who studied data and who was wheeled into the room by Dominic Cummings, who ran an artificial intelligence company. And he was the one who convinced Boris Johnson, apparently, to lock down. Matthew Side wrote the piece in the Sunday Times. An extraordinary piece. They're calling this guy a genius when, in fact, he had no reason other than the data that he was showing about what might happen to make it happen.
Yeah, I'd probably not go through this again, because I'd try as anyone might. I think this is now what the world has accepted, and we've now moved into an era of less freedom and more government power than we ever saw before, and one can only resist it from time to time. Could I, by the way, make a small comment on the murder of Sir David Amess? That I think a lot of people are jumping to a lot of conclusions at the moment. We know, it seems to me, almost nothing about it, except that it took place. And I would urge huge caution in deciding what the manner of the event is. There's been no trial. The last time I looked, there hadn't even been a charge. So again, we mustn't presume anything at all. And I would just urge a great deal of caution on everybody before leaping to conclusions about what it means and what it's all about, because I just don't think we have adequate information to do that.
No, I don't think so. But I guess my question is, were we already sort of softened up for it, if you like, so that when the time came last March 2020, people were more willing than they perhaps would have been otherwise?
I think that societies do tend to be conformists. But the great thing about the Britain that I grew up in was that it had a substantial number of people, a critical mass of people, who were prepared to say, no, I don't agree with that. And these were people in every place. And I wrote an article, we discussed it last week, about my time as a Labour correspondent. Well, the trade unions, for instance, were full of people who'd become important by standing up for themselves on behalf of others, not doing what they were told, not agreeing with everything everybody had told them. There was a spirit of standing up to authority in the trade unions. There was a spirit of standing up to authority in Parliament. MPs genuinely opposed the government, and there were fantastic figures, such as the late Tam DL MP, who made a profession out of not believing what the government told him. And quite rightly, I don't think he has an equivalent now. And there was a lot more dissent in the press. And the other thing was our education system still turned out people who understood the necessity to obtain facts before reaching opinions. And that's all gone now. People are taught opinions rather than taught the knowledge which enables them to form them. As I repeatedly say, people are taught not how to think, but what to think.
Yeah.
And many, many years of that had had its effect when it came to the shutdown over COVID. It was amazing how much more passive and willing to accept being told what to do our society was, and how none of the safety valves worked. Neither the media, nor the courts, nor Parliament, nor the opposition actually tried to establish whether this was the right thing to do. And so there we are. But what do we do about it? Can we reconstruct these things? I personally think not, but some people might think it's worth a try. But at the very least, can we try and make sure it doesn't get any worse?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think the trouble is now we've reached a point where it's not so much where you're taught what to think, but you're taught what not to think. And which opinion not to have.
Well, that also is true, yes. People are frightened out of thinking certain things.
Yeah. I mean, they totally are. And they're very frightened of speaking out. I mean, the whole debates that rage around academia now are so ridiculous as to be kind of almost laughable, aren't they?
Well, you would, but this is the thing. I mean, what George Orwell said about the goose step, the countries in which the army did the goose step were countries in which it was dangerous to laugh at things which were patently ridiculous.
Yeah.
The goose step is ridiculous, but when in Soviet Russia or in Nazi Germany or Mussolini's Italy, when the troops went by doing their high kicks, people did not laugh. It was dangerous to laugh, even though it was ridiculous. And we reached position. And what's happening in our universities at the moment is beyond belief.
Yeah, but this is one of the
every
strange.
Every time it's laughed at, it those who laugh at it get into trouble, and it continues and intensifies.
Yeah, but this is why, again, every kind of argument that happens, and in the wake of what happened on Friday and the murder of an MP, suddenly we're having conversations about whether we should be kinder to one another and whether we should stop being mean on Twitter, as if somehow that was the cause of an MP being murdered by a terrorist, which, of course,
well,
it wasn't.
If the alleged killer was a terrorist, we don't know that. Maybe this is the reason. Maybe there is an awful lot of hatred about it, but part of the point of Parliament, of course, is that it provides a safety valve for the strong passions which major contentious issues bring about in a society. People like to see in Parliament the government under pressure, the opposition being tough. They don't mind the shouting or the heckling at Prime Minister's Question Time, because they think, well, at least in this country, we know that our opinions are being properly represented. I don't think they are anymore, anything like as well as they used to be, but that's the point of Parliament. So the idea which is being propagated by some people at the moment that MPs should be hidden away and should cease to have contact with the public seems to me to be a grave mistake. I mean, obviously, we should take all reasonable precautions to prevent them from being killed in such horrible circumstances, but they mustn't be allowed to go into hiding. We would regret that forever if that was allowed to happen.
Yes, I think the idea of trying to, you know, somehow protect MPs around the clock with some ludicrous amount of money and ludicrous amount of people which is completely and utterly impracticable anyway, isn't really the way forward. But by the same token, I think it's also ridiculous to try and kind of assimilate the two things as though people being horrible to you on Twitter somehow creates a terribly bad atmosphere where people start running around murdering one another.
Well, no, but I think there is a viciousness in our public debate at the moment, which is dangerous. I don't think that's entirely wrong. To point out that this happens. If you are ever the target, as I have been, of this sliming on Twitter, I've learned to expect it. I can't allow myself to be scared by it, but I won't pretend that it's pleasant.
Mm.
And I think sometimes it takes on a form which is extraordinarily vicious and contains, in some cases, the implication of violence.
Yeah.
I've had people speculating on Twitter about kicking me off my bicycle when riding along the road. I just think that people, especially when they're anonymous, so many of the worst offenders on social media are, especially when they're anonymous, they do go much too far. So I don't, whether this is in any way connected with the tragedy of Sir David Amess, I would not like to say. But I don't think it's untrue to say there is a very low and nasty mood on social media at the moment. One has to keep reminding oneself that this person saying these things is probably somebody sitting in his mother's basement, quite converting sugary drinks into human lard, and that shouldn't necessarily be taken too seriously. But it doesn't feel like that when you're on the receiving end of it, and you aren't some leathery old crocodile from Fleet Street.
No, but also there is the other side of it, which is the non-anonymous side, where you've got these kind of activists who have become very adept at contacting all the right people should they wish to try and get you to lose your job. You know, they're very good at contacting the people in your organisation who might be, a little bit fragile about it, or people in the advertising world, or people who, you know, might be supportive of you financially. You know, they're getting very good at sort of cornering you off and singling you out and making sure that they tell all the people that need to know what a terrible, horrible person you are, in the hopes that you'll be cancelled.
Well, this, I'm afraid, is the world in which we live. And there it is again. It's all the same thing tending in this awful direction of a closed rather than an open society, in which it becomes a personal failing to dissent, and you're not just wrong, but you're bad. And I can't see a good end to it. And,
no,
but it needs. The only thing I can do is draw attention to it, in the hope that maybe somebody will find a way of starting a long march back through the institutions to try and undo this and get us back to a position where we tolerate and treat with civilization our opponents rather than viewing them as enemies to be hated and despised.
Yes.
And I do try to be civil to people who attack me. And there is a limit. I will sometimes, after it's clear that somebody is incapable of civilized discourse, I will sometimes hit back because I think it's just and necessary. But if I possibly can stay civil, I do, and I urge other people to do the same thing.
Yes, and do you think that also the politicians now bear some blame for some of this, because they have become slightly deranged about one another's opponents as well?
Well, some of them have, but the main blame they bear is that they've pretty much decided that a huge number of issues are closed, and that the things which divide this country. And it's an interesting thing. You look up Sir David Amess. He was a man of very conservative social and moral views. And although he's now rightly being, as people who died are, rightly being treated with a great deal of courtesy in death, a lot of the people who are treating him with courtesy in death would not have agreed with what he said about these things.
No.
And those opinions on, say, abortion or capital punishment were marginal in the parliament in which he sat, although they might well have been held by a large number of his constituents. I don't think Parliament, either of the major parties in Parliament, anymore make a very good job of representing the real spectrum of opinion. They've accepted a very narrow, crudely defined as politically correct view of all kinds of things, which simply isn't believed in by an awful lot of people. And so, as a result, a lot of political debate has got outside Parliament and outside conventional politics, and one of the places it emerges is in these furious and bilious and personally vicious attacks on social media. So if Parliament were more representative of the true divisions in the country, I think it would draw a lot of the poison out of the internet. But it's precisely because it isn't that it doesn't.
Yes. I think that's about right. Peter, thanks very much indeed. Peter Hitchens, Metal Sunday Column. There's a little bit of interference on the line, though. I'm not quite sure if that was in the background or whether it was just something that was going on while we were talking to him. Apologies if you had trouble hearing that. However, lots more for us to do. A lot of common sense spoken by Peter Hitchens there, who does say, along with many people, actually he believes that there is a toxic nature to some of the discourse in this country, and that does lead to violence. That does lead to bad places. That does lead to criminality. I'm not so sure, but maybe you agree with him.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, lots of you have been in touch with me over the course of the last several months about how difficult it has been for many of you to actually see a doctor. We had a case yesterday of a set of parents saying that their son, who was around about 26, died as a result of not being able to see a doctor because they weren't able to see what was actually wrong with him. And it turned out he had some kind of brain aneurysm and he died at the age of 26. Absolutely horrendous, absolutely ghastly, and it shouldn't be happening. We now find out that actually there's no doctor in almost half of GP appointments, according to data from the NHS themselves. And the reason for that is because there are nurses, medicine dispensers, health visitors, acupuncturists, osteopaths, chiropodists, picking up an increasing amount of the load. Let's talk now to Dr. Lawrence Buckman, former chair of the BMA GPs Committee and a North London GP himself. Dr. Lawrence, very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
We seem to keep having the same conversation, Lawrence, doesn't seem to be getting any better. In fact, for the BMA to now come out and say that anyone who's asking for doctors to go and see patients face to face is actually harassing them and discriminating against them is mad, isn't it?
Well, can I just emphasise, I have no position within the BMA and I'm not speaking for them. Those days happily ended a long time ago now. So I'm now speaking for myself as a GP.
Yes.
And I'm not going to attempt to defend poor practice. What I will observe is that the number of patients needing to be spoken to or seen in general practice has increased enormously. These are NHS figures, not mine. And that enormous increase has been matched by a fairly significant fall in GP numbers. The number of people seen physically face-to-face in general practice has actually increased since before the pandemic. Mm. The huge increase in workload has had to go somewhere, and since there aren't enough GPs, it's had to go to a whole variety of other people. Now, we might argue that that wasn't a bad thing, but patients wanting to see, quite rightly, wanting to see a GP face-to-face are now struggling to get appointments because there are not enough doctors working in general practice to deliver care to the greatly increased number of people who quite reasonably want to see a doctor.
Yeah. It doesn't seem a terribly difficult circle to square, does it? I mean, it doesn't seem incredibly hard to look at what you've just said and then take a sort of, reasonably educated approach to that and say, right, well, how do we fix it then?
Right. The fixing it problem is difficult because for the last 20 years, once upon a time, it was me telling the government. Now it's my successors telling the government. We were explaining to whichever government it was that the number of GPs was going to fall because the number of retirements was rising and was inevitably going to get worse. And wave after wave of government listeners have decided they weren't going to do much about that. They promise they're going to have 5,000 more GPs, but the fact is the numbers are falling. Mm. My successors in general practice don't want to work the kind of hours I worked. People like me were seen as a quaint oddity, dinosaurs that saw a lot of people in the surgery. And no longer do we have a workforce that can deliver to those people. So what we need, of course, is to grow the workforce. And the only short-term solution is to bring in other people, like you've said, all those paramedical people, right, many of whom can do the job at least as well as us, if not better. But still there is a need for people to see GPs face-to-face, and there are not enough bodies.
But there are equally, and we know this because the GPs have told us that this is one of the reasons they're not available to see patients, is there have been plenty of GPs available to hand out vaccines to people because they get a bit of an extra bunce for that, and that could be quite lucrative.
That would be true, except the large number of us who went to give vaccines voluntarily. I wasn't paid a halfpenny for vaccinating people, and I think many of my colleagues who were either retired or part-retired just did it for nothing. Mm. But you're quite right. Those GPs who did the COVID vaccinations in the first two waves did receive money for doing it. But when you took out the cost of setting up outdoor venues, most of us worked outdoors. You can't imagine how cold it is in February when you're vaccinating people for 8 hours on a run. The costs were nearly all taken up by the in the profit. So there wasn't much money made in it, actually. I'd like to think there was money made, but it's not true.
Right. Well, I mean, my general view of the world is that people will do things for money faster than they'll do things for nothing. And so while I'm sure that part of what you say is right, equally part of what I say is right. And if you're going to take away from your regular day-to-day job in order to do anything, then obviously there's going to be a problem when you go back to your day-to-day job, when you find that all the people that wanted to see you are still waiting there.
That's right. And it was obvious that this was going to happen. Like I say, this was an accident waiting to happen. And now the drive to do things in a way that is more efficient, if we call it that, seeing people remotely, most GPs will tell you that for quite a lot of patients, remote is not really satisfactory. And you're finding cases all the time of people who would have been better if they would have been seen face to face and probably more quickly.
Yes.
The difficulty is that there just isn't the workforce there. And the problem I think the BMA were surfacing, and I can't speak for them, I'm only trying to interpret what I've read the same as you, is that there was a suggestion that GPs would be forced. And in a difficult situation where morale is awful and people are working quite hard, and there are an awful lot of people just on the brink of retirement or who could be pushed quite easily, forcing people as opposed to encouraging them is something that I think is a mistake. So whilst I would strongly encourage my colleagues to see as many patients face to face as they humanly can, there's a point where they physically can't. And to then force them to do more, I don't think is a terribly good idea.
No, I think forcing anyone to do anything is a very bad idea, in the same way that up in Scotland, which we're about to talk about, you're basically forcing people to take a vaccine in order to go to a nightclub, despite the fact that everybody else in the nightclub isn't vaccinated, so supposedly they're not in any danger, but that's another story. The problem for me here, Lawrence, is that, you know, this has not come as any great surprise to anyone. You know, we haven't suddenly woken up and gone, oh dear, there's not enough doctors. You know, we've got a massively increased population. Our own population has gone up probably by about 5 to 7 million in the last 10 years. We've got more pressure on GP surgeries. We've got stories coming out last week saying that some GPs have as many as 3,000 patients on their books. Now, obviously, you can't possibly see all of them. But again, somebody needs to get a grip of it and say, well, let's restructure the way it all works. Surely. I mean, I'm getting sick to death of saying this.
Yes, and you.
If I came into work every day and we didn't have enough people in the control room to make the show go out, I'd make sure that we eventually did. I wouldn't keep coming in every day and complaining we didn't have enough people in the control room.
No, there are several things you can do. One is quite quick, and I'm glad the government has finally got round to letting GPs relax the rules on surgery cleaning after patients have come in. The COVID restrictions have made it really difficult for people to be seen. Once they take that away, and I think they will, that will greatly increase the number of face-to-face appointments potentially. Mm. The next, I'm afraid, is a 10-year thing, which is growing more doctors. That takes time. You can't just do that. And the third, I'm afraid, is that they're going to have some system for sieving out patients who really do need to be seen faster. Mm. Now that word triage, which is a warm word, really, it comes from the army. The idea that you should somehow triage patients better is something that was tried during the pandemic. The NHS 111 service ran a COVID service. I know because I used to work for it. And all those people who had COVID or might have had were sorted before they ever got anywhere near a hospital, 999, a GP. And there was a whole team of doctors, a huge number actually, 1,500 at the maximum, delivering care to patients more quickly. And surely the time has come when that overflow of patients who need something urgently or semi-urgently, the people with lumps, for example, stuff like that, where they clearly can't be left, they need to reinstate a service like that that would deal with the overflow. We can't have people waiting 3 or 4 weeks for a routine appointment for something that isn't simple. And that's something we could do fairly quickly and now. And why the government abandoned the specialist 111 service as opposed to the routine one is a mystery, because it was up and running and there was great camaraderie and it did deliver for patients much more quickly than my poor colleagues in general practice are able to do because of the workload pressure.
Well, interestingly, one of the pieces that I read over the course of the weekend, I mentioned to Peter Hitchens already, was about a guy who's been given credit with sort of making Boris Johnson become convinced that the lockdown was necessary. And he was a sort of artificial intelligence tech geek, effectively, who was brought in by Dominic Cummings, who was very good at modelling. He was very good at sort of, you know, looking at data. He was very good at analysing data. He basically said, look, what we want to do here is take away from the NHS all of the kind of rigmarole of manually entering data, which an awful lot of people apparently in the NHS do. And, you know, the one thing that I thought about his description of the NHS was that it is still very much an old-fashioned, you know, very untechnologically forward-thinking organisation. And so it seems to me there's an awful lot of paperwork that goes on. And many people will tell me this. I mean, I'm fortunate because I don't, as I say, have much to do with doctors. But, you know, the amount of paperwork that gets done, the number of pieces of paper that get handed to people, that get sent out to people, you know, they need to modernise it, for God's sake, is what I'm saying.
I'm afraid the NHS IT is astonishingly slow, and the bureaucracy is ever more detailed, because of course the NHS is convinced that most of the people who work for it are busy committing fraud. Actually, they're so busy they haven't got the time to commit fraud. Right. Chance of being a fine thing.
No, I'm sure that's true, but I mean, again, we keep having these conversations, you know, why can we not compartmentalize the NHS properly so that it's run properly, rather than, you know, people like yourself, Lawrence, who I know are obviously very good at your job. You know what you need to do, but there's no way to make it happen. It's kind of like, you know, it must be frustrating, because you've got government ministers who probably should be well out of it and left to run the government and not get involved in health policy. And then you've got NHS managers who seem to be almost incapable of doing anything quickly. And, you know, it's just this sort of behemoth that needs fixing.
Well, whenever you hear the phrase lessons will be learned, you know for sure lessons will not be learned.
That's true.
And we struggle against a very inert tanker that is astonishingly difficult to turn round. Mm. Why can't we turn it round? Well, because there is a political agenda plonked on top of the NHS's sets of agendas. And of course, the must-dos come from the top, from politicians, not from the NHS. I would love to see a depoliticised health service, one that just got on with the job properly and wasn't micromanaged by ministerial and government diktat. It shouldn't make any difference who's in power. Health for all should be a thing that we should all believe in and all deliver. And the NHS really does struggle with the next great idea from Westminster. It'd be wonderful if they stopped having ideas.
Well, indeed, or at least if they had a proper idea and a proper, I mean, they talk a lot about this money that's going to come into the business as of April of next year, once they start taxing us all a bit more. But you know as well as I do, it's going to be just like dropping, you know, a load of air into a load of air. You know, you won't see any difference. Nothing's going to change.
No, nothing, sadly.
No, exactly right. So what should people do? How do you get to see a doctor if you are having trouble? Because obviously our thoughts today are with David Nash, who was a 26-year-old mature law student, right, whose parents are saying that he died because the shambolic NHS 111 service didn't allow him to see a doctor. And it turned out he died of meningitis and he had something called a mastoiditis in his ear, which caused a brain abscess, which could have been seen by anyone who looked at him. But because nobody looked at him, they didn't see it.
I don't want to talk about the individual case, only to say that mastoiditis is remarkably difficult to diagnose with absolute certainty. But what it would mean is you'd have to go to hospital to diagnose it, but that somebody touching it would have spotted something was odd. It is difficult to diagnose. But let's move on from the individual case and talk in general. We all have to be much more careful about what we do. And what should the parents or patients do? When you want to get into contact with your GP, firstly, explain what the problem is, if you can get through the telephone barrier. Mm. If you can go online And your practice has an online connection, and you can do that if you're able to, recognizing that 20% of the population are not able to do that because they don't have the kit or they don't have the wherewithal. If you can go online, most practices are very prompt about getting you back. If you get in the phone queue, the usual one where you're 30th in the queue, and when you get to the top, they say there's no more appointments.
Right.
If that happens to you, then what I suggest you do is you either go to the surgery, not to demand an immediate appointment, but to go to the surgery to say,
I need an appointment. I've had people tell me stories, Lawrence, that they've done that and they've been told to go home and phone.
Well, that's absolutely bonkers.
Well, yeah, but that's what's happening.
I have had that happen to me. So I sat in the waiting room and telephoned my GP from the waiting room in the surgery. And strangely, the receptionist came and said, don't be so stupid.
Right.
We'll sort you out.
Okay.
And the fact is,
you try gluing yourself to the door, I suppose.
You could do all that kind of thing. But the main thing is so that a GP, as opposed to a computer or a receptionist or anybody else, intercepts the problem before a doctor has had a chance to listen.
Yes.
Most doctors, once they've had the chance to hear you, will then do something promptly, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And many of the times they can deal with it on the phone or online, but they can't always. And when they can't, the time is to get make sure you can be heard by a doctor, preferably your doctor, but failing that a doctor and failing that 111, because 111 also have access to your doctor's appointments.
Yes.
They can make you an appointment if necessary. I know, because when I was working for them, that's exactly what I did. And there are various ways of getting through. Ultimately, though, there is not enough medical time to see everybody. Mm. Getting rid of the COVID cleaning will make it much easier. That is definitely an instant win. Mm. And I'm glad they finally got round to doing it.
Yes.
They could have done it earlier and it would have helped more.
I think so.
And for a quickie, I would reinstate the 111 specialist service, which also, although it must have cost a mint, actually delivered a ferocious service to patients, which I think they deserve.
Yes. Well, apparently it doesn't matter how much it costs anymore, so we should be doing all of that. Dr. Lawrence Buckman, very, very nice to talk to you. Thank you, as ever, for some common sense. Former chair of the BMA GPs committee. He's a North London GP now as well. You know, the story just goes on and on and on. It's like dragging a corpse around with you. It's like not ever finding somewhere that you can get the thing fixed. I mean, there must be a way, surely, to God. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.